Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 3, Number 9.
Qi Qian aspired to be the greatest archer in the world, so he became a pupil of Wei Fei. First Wei Fei ordered him to learn not to blink. Qi Qian crept under his wife's loom and lay there on his back, staring without blinking at the treadle as it rushed up and down directly before his eyes. After 2 years, he had reached the point of not blinking, even if one of his eyelashes were caught in the treadle. "To know how not to blink is only the first step," said Wei Fei. "Next you must learn to look. Practice looking at things. And if the time comes when the minute seems conspicuous and what is small seems huge, visit me once more." Qi Qian searched for a tiny insect, hardly visible to the naked eye, placed it on a blade of grass and hung it up by the window of his study. He then took up a position at the end of the room and sat there day after day staring at the insect. At first he could hardly see it, but after 10 days he began to fancy that it was slightly bigger. For 3 years he hardly left his study. Then one day he perceived that the insect by the window was as big as a horse. "I've done it," he exclaimed. This time the teacher was sufficiently impressed to say, "Well done." Qi Qian soon became a master of archery, and no feat of bowmanship now seemed beyond his powers. He seemed close to the achievement of his ambition, but with an unpleasant jolt, he realized that one obstacle remained. So long as the master Wei Fei lived, Qi Qian could never call himself the greatest archer in the world. Walking through the fields one day, Qi Qian caught sight of Wei Fei far in the distance. Without a moment's hesitation, he raised his bow, fixed an arrow, and took aim. His old master, however, had sensed what was happening, and in a flash had also notched an arrow. Both men fired at the same moment. Their arrows collided halfway and fell together to the ground. This strange duel continued until the master's quiver was empty, but one arrow still remained with the pupil. "Now is my chance," muttered Qi Qian, who immediately aimed the final arrow. Seeing this, Wei Fei broke off a twig from a thorn bush beside him, and as the arrow sped towards his heart, he flicked the point sharply with the tip of one of the thorns and brought it to the ground at his feet. "My friend," said Wei Fei, "I have now, as you realize, transmitted to you all the knowledge of archery that I possess. If you wish to delve further into these mysteries, you must seek the aged master Kan Ying. Compared to his skill, our bowmanship is the puny fumbling of children." After months of arduous climbing, Qi Qian reached the cave where dwelt Kan Ying and announced to the old man, "I have come to find out if I am as great an archer as I believe." And without waiting for a reply, he notched an arrow, aimed at a flock of migrating birds, and brought down 5 birds all at once. The old man smiled and said, "But this is mere shooting with bow and arrow. You have not yet learned to shoot without shooting. Come with me." Qi Qian followed him in silence to the edge of a great cliff. When he glanced down, his eyes became blurred and his head began to spin. Meanwhile, the master Kan Ying ran lightly onto the narrow ledge which jutted straight out over the precipice, and turning round said, "Now show me your real skill. Come here when I am standing and let me see your bowmanship." When Qi Qian stepped on the ledge, it began to sway slightly to and fro. He tried to notch an arrow, but he soon felt that he was going to lose his balance. He lay down on the edge, clutching its edges firmly with his fingers. His legs shook and the perspiration flowed from his whole body. The old man laughed, reached out his hand and helped Chi Chang down. Jumping onto it himself, he says, "Allow me, sir, to show you what archery really is." "But what about your bow?" asked Chi Chang. "My bow?" said the old man, laughing. "So long as one requires bow and arrow, one is still at the periphery of the art. Real archery dispenses with both bow and arrow." Directly above their heads, a single kite was wheeling in the sky. The hermit looked up at it, and Chi Chang followed his gaze. So high was the bird that even to his sharp eyes, it looked like a small sesame seed. Kan Ying notched an invisible arrow on an incorporeal bow, drew the string to its full extent, and released it. The next moment the kite stopped flapping its wings and fell like a stone to the ground. For 9 years Chi Chang stayed in the mountains with the old hermit. What disciplines he underwent during this time, no one ever knew. When in the 10th year he returned home, all were amazed at the change in him. His former resolute and arrogant countenance had disappeared. In its place had come to look the look of a simpleton. His old teacher, Wei Fei, came to visit him and said after a single glance, "Now I see that you have indeed become an expert, such as I no longer worthy ever to touch your feet." The inhabitants of this city hailed Chi Chang as the greatest archer in the world and impatiently awaited the wonderful feats which he would no doubt soon display. But Chi Chang did nothing to satisfy their expectations. The great poplar bow which he had taken with him on his journey, he evidently had left behind. When someone asked him to explain, he answered in a languid tone, "The ultimate stage of activity is inactivity. The ultimate stage of speaking is to refrain from speech. The ultimate in shooting is not to shoot." Chi Chang grew old. More and more he seemed to have entered the state in which both mind and body look no longer to things outside, but exist by themselves in restful and elegant simplicity. His stolid face divested itself of every vestige of expression. No outside force could disturb his complete impassiveness. It was rare now for him to speak, and presently no one could longer tell whether or not he still breathed. In the evening of his life, he no longer knew the difference between this and that. The kaleidoscope of sensory impressions no longer concerned him. For all he cared, his eye might have been an ear, his ear a nose, his nose a mouth. Of the last year, the story is told that one day he visited a friend's house and saw lying on the table a vaguely familiar utensil, whose name he could not, however, recall. He turned to his friend and said, "Pray tell me, that object on your table, what is it called, and for what is it used?" The friend stammered out in an awestruck tone, "Oh, master, you must indeed be the greatest master of all times. Only so can you have forgotten the bow, both its name and its use." It was said that for some time after this in the city, painters threw away their brushes, musicians broke the strings of their instruments, and carpenters were ashamed to be seen with their rules.
A man of the people one day asks Master Ikau, "Master, will you write for me some maxims of high wisdom?" Ikau took up a brush and wrote the word, "Look." "Is that all?" said the man. "Won't you add a few more words?" Ikau then wrote twice, "Look, look." "All the same," said the disappointed man, "I don't see much depth or subtlety in what you have written there." Ikau then wrote the same word 3 times. Slightly irritated, the man said, "After all, what does this word look mean?" And a cow replied, "Look means look." This one word, look, contains the whole message of Zen. Fra Giovanni, in AD 1513, said, "The gloom of the world is but a shadow. Behind it, yet within reach, is joy. There is a radiance and glory in the darkness, could we but see. And to see, we have only to look. I beseech you to look." The word look is exactly the whole substance of Zen. How to look contains all religion. How to look with pure eyes, so much so that there comes a unity in look where the object and the subject both disappear, and only pure look remains. In that purity of looking, nobody looking at and nobody looking at anything, in that purity of look, darshan, in that vision, truth is known. Zen people talk about three pillars of Zen. These are the three pillars. They prepare you for the look. First is no form, second is no mind, third is no soul. This will look strange, particularly because people who are accustomed with so-called religion know it almost as a cliché that man has three existences, the physical, the psychological and the spiritual. And the politician and the priest and the professors go on talking about the health, the balance between the physical and the psychological and the spiritual. Zen says, no mind means no psychology. No form means no body, no matter. And no soul means no spirit, no self. Zen says, the physical is the grass ego. Ego, number one. The psychological is a little more subtle, less grass, but is still the ego. Ego, number two. And the so-called spiritual is the subtlest ego. The ego, number three. But they are all egos. And all these three egos make one egoist, create one egoist. It is Zen which goes to the deepest root of the illness called man. It says, unless a person comes to see that the form is illusory, that the thought is illusory, not only that, but the person believed, inferred to be behind the mind, the self, is also illusory. When these all three have been known, looked into, and found a lacking of substantiality, there arises the look. That look gives you that which is real, that which is. These are the three pillars of Zen. No form means all the forms in the world are fluid, in a flux. The child is becoming young and the young man is becoming old, and the old man is dying, and the dying is getting ready to be born again. One form constantly changes into another form. It is a flux of forms. No form is substantial because no form abides. All forms come and go. They are dreams. Bubbles, soap bubbles. They are there one moment and another moment they are not there. Their existence is momentary. They are made of the stuff dreams are made. The real is that which remains forever and forever. The real is that which is timeless. Forms are not real because they don't abide. Look into the forms. When a cow said look, first look means look into the grossest ego, ego number one. The master, a cow, was indicating a great maxim, the greatest. When he said, first look, and wrote the word look, he was saying, look into the body, into the form. You are not that. And it is not real. Substance is very non-substantial. Illusory. Magical. The first look is look into ego number one. Once you have understood that the form goes on changing, you cannot become attached to the form. You cannot get identified with the form. How you can be identified with that which comes and goes? In the morning, it is light, in the night it is dark. You are sitting in your room, comes morning, and the room becomes full of rays, and there is light. And comes afternoon, and comes evening, and it is becoming dark, and the sun disappears, and the room becomes dark, and it is night, and it is utterly dark. You cannot say, I was the morning, or I was the afternoon, or I was the evening, or I am the night. You cannot say. You are the watcher, the looker. Morning comes and goes, evening comes and goes, you go on watching. Childhood is a morning, youth is the afternoon, old age is the evening, and then the dark night, the death. And so on, the wheel moves. But who you are, look. The first look of IQ means look into the form, the grossest. Learn from there. Once you have looked in the grossest and the ego number one has disappeared, you will be able to see into the second, the psychological. Then you can see your body is just a fluid, flux, constantly changing. So is your mind. Thoughts are moving so fast. Not for a single moment the thought remains, comes and goes. How you can be these thoughts? These thoughts are just like moving clouds in the sky. The traffic on the road. You are the watcher. Look. The second time when Iku said, look, look. He meant look into the ego number two, the psychological. If you look deeply, you will come to know you are not the mind. No form. No mind. Then remains the subtlest kind of the ego number three. You start thinking that you are a soul, a self. that too is false. Look into that too. And you will be surprised that when you look into yourself, you find vast emptiness and nothing else. Even the self is not found. The guests have disappeared, and suddenly you see even the host is no more there. The guest and the host were all ghosts. They have all disappeared. Silence remains. Utter silence. No sound. Neither of the guest nor of the host. All dialogue has stopped. All turmoil disappears. There is utter emptiness, nothingness. This is looking into the third. When Ikku said, look, look, look. The third ego, the subtlest, the hardest and the most difficult to look into it. There are people, the so-called materialists, who say, the grass is the real. They stop there. They don't go beyond that. The Charvakas, the Marxists, the communists, they stop at the first door. They never go beyond it. There are idealists who go a little deeper. They say the form is not true, but the mind is truth. Matter is not true, but mind is true. They believe in mind against matter. They stop at the second. Then there are the spiritualists. They go a little more deeper. They say even the mind is not true. Only the self, the soul, the Atman is true. Zen goes farthest, deepest. Nobody has penetrated so deeply in the mystery of human being as Buddha. Buddha says even the self, even the soul, the Atman is not true. It is the last trace of ego. Very, very last, but still it is the last trace of the ego. The very idea that I am is a persistence, a shadow of the old ego. When you look into this too, the self also disappears. And when all have gone, what is left? Only a pure look. This is very difficult to understand unless you go into it existentially. Only the pure look, because then it becomes illogical. How there can be pure look if there is nobody to look? But that's how it is. It is paradoxical. In language it is difficult to say what remains. Only pure look remains. There is nobody who is looking. There is nobody at whom you are looking. The looked at and the looker both have disappeared. The subject and object both has disappeared. There is just pure look. A silence, but very alive silence. No way to define it. Indefinable. You cannot even say this is the self. Just a witnessing. A sakshin. But to use the word witness can create trouble. Because the moment we use the word witness, we start thinking somebody is there who is witnessing. So Buddha says, no witness, only witnessing. No looker, only look. No meditator, only meditation. No one who has attained to samadhi, but only pure samadhi. This is difficult because we have been brought up in a certain structure of language. When somebody is running, we say there are two things, the runner and the running. Buddha says there is only running, there is no runner. The runner is just inference. Buddha says there is only action, activity, there is no actor. When you say the tree is growing, you believe tacitly that the tree is one thing and growing is another. Buddha says there is only growing, there is no tree. When the river is flowing, you say the river is flowing. Buddha says there is only flowing. Where is the river? Buddha believes in verbs, and our languages are rooted in nouns that creates trouble. Buddha says existence is a verb. It is a process. There are no things at all. All are processes. I am talking to you, but there is no talker. And you are listening to me, but there is no listener. If you can understand that existentially, then only you will be able to understand what Buddha means when he says, even the third ego disappears. Right now, let it be an existential experience. Is there a listener, or there is only listening? If you look backwards, if you try to recapitulate, the listener comes in. The listener is a memory. If you start thinking about it, certainly you will find the listener there, because listener is the memory. But when you are listening, there is only listening, there is no listener. When you are running, there is only running. When you have come to a point where you stop, sit under a tree to rest, and then you look backwards in the memory, you find a runner. The runner is a memory creation. It was not in the actual, in the existential. It is just in the memory, trace has been left of many acts. How to join those acts into one. Those beads of separate acts have to be joined, otherwise it will be difficult for you to remember. So you create a thread. You thread those beads with an idea of the runner. That becomes your ego. There are individual atomic acts, and there is nothing joining them. That is what modern physics has come to. The modern physicist's standpoint about existence is exactly Buddhist, very close to Buddha. Modern physics also says there are only atomic existences. And those atomic existences are also not in any way substantial, they are just energy fields, not matter, just energy fields. And there is constant change. Nothing abides. Everything is in a flux. These three pillars destroy your whole structure of the ego. This is a very negative kind of trinity. Christianity has trinity. The God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And Hindus have the concept of Trimurti, three faces of God, Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh. But they are all positive things. This Zen approach towards reality is utterly negative. These are the three pillars, no form, no mind, no soul. When you have looked through everything and found no, then what is left? That which is left is indefinable. That which is left is truth. Buddha keeps silent about it. It cannot be said. The moment you say it, you falsify it. This state, when you have come to know no form, no mind, no self, is called Wu in Chinese, Samadhi in Sanskrit, Satori in Japanese. Few characteristics of Samadhi, then you will be able to go into this tremendously beautiful story. There are 7 characteristics of Samadhi. First is oneness, at one moment, duality disappears. The division between the known and the knower disappears. Fusion arises. Confusion disappears. There are no more two. But remember, the moment Buddha says there are no more two, he is not saying there is one. He keeps utter silence about the one. He says, only say there are not two. Because the moment you say one, you bring the two again. Because one is meaningless without the two. Not two. That's all. The runner and the running are not there. You and I are not there. The speaker and the listener are not there. Existence is an organic unity. There is no duality in it. It is all oneness, but Buddha never calls it one. He is very careful. He avoids all kinds of logical pitfalls. He is very, very alert not to fall into any logical fallacy. He will not say, existence is one. Because what you will mean by one if there is not two? The figure one is meaningful only with the figure two. Without the figure two, one will not mean anything at all. If we say God is light, it can only be meaningful if darkness exists. Then devil becomes darkness. Without the context of the devil and darkness, what it will mean that God is light? It will not mean anything. Buddha simply says, God is neither light nor darkness. God is not two. Truth is not two. That is the first experience of Samadhi. That by and by, the two-ness of life disappears. Why the two-ness is created? It is created by these three egos. When I see this body as my body, then your body becomes your body. When I become attached to my form, your form becomes aligned, the others. The moment I see my body as not my body, the moment I see myself as formless, then the other also disappears. With the self disappears the others. Without the I, the thou cannot exist. They exist together in a pair. So the first characteristic of Samadhi is two-ness in life disappears. A great harmony arises. It is all one. That is the meaning of fusion. Confusion arises because of the two. Then there is class, continuous class. The second characteristic of Samadhi is orgasmicness, blissfulness, beatitude. Unless you come to this utter annihilation of all the egos, you will never be happy. You will never be blissful. Misery is a byproduct of the ego. And because there are three egos, there are three kind of miseries. the physical misery, the psychological misery, and the spiritual misery. You may not have heard the third kind, the spiritual misery. You may not have even thought about it as misery. But look, a man is poor and he wants to be rich. He is miserable. Everybody knows he is miserable. And if you go to a religious priest, he will say, "Don't be greedy. Money is just dirt. Don't bother about it. Blessed are the poor. You be contented whatsoever you have." But then the man starts trying to become a better musician, or a better poet, or a better painter. You will not be so much against him as you were when he was too much greedy for money. If he was too much greedy for politics and power and this and that, everybody would have condemned him. But now if he wants to try to create a better painting, better art, write better poetry, nobody will be so much against. But he will be in misery again. Now the misery will be more psychological. He wants to become a Shakespeare. It is the same game played on another plane. First he wanted to become a Rockefeller. Now he wants to become a Shakespeare. But the beginning is there. If you go to a perceptive man, he will say, this is the same greed. Asserting on another plane, on a deeper plane, drop it. This is meaningless. Even if you become a Shakespeare, nothing is attained. Shakespeare is as miserable as you. Even if you create great works of art, you will not be blissful. You can go and see great painters and musicians and they are not blissful. So you become Christ or Buddha. That is going to help. You become a Krishna. It is there that bliss etches. And then a person starts trying to become a Christ or a Buddha. This is creating a spiritual misery. It is the same misery. Now it has penetrated even deeper. Now it has gone to the third ego level. Spiritual. Now nobody will condemn you unless you come across a Buddha. Nobody will condemn you. They will say you are a spiritual man. If you are crying and weeping and suffering because you want to attain to God and you want to attain to Samadhi and Moksha and Nirvana, who is going to condemn you? People will worship you. They will say, look, what a great spiritual man is here. He does not hanker for money. He does not bother for fame. He simply cries and weeps for God. Here is a spiritual man. These are your so-called saints. But if you look deeply, you will find they are spiritually miserable. Now, the problem is the same. First you wanted to become a Rockefeller, then you wanted to become a Shakespeare, now you want to become Buddha. But you want to become, becoming persists. Tanha, becoming persists, the desire to be somebody else continues. Now you want to become God. Nothing has changed. There are three kinds of miseries, because there are three kinds of egos. When all the egos have been dropped, when there is no point in any desire left, when all your desires have failed, let me repeat it. In spirituality, in religion, only one succeeds who has utterly failed. It will look like a paradox. To fail utterly with desire is to enter into the real world. Till you have some hope to succeed somewhere, you will never enter the reality. Then your hope will go on dragging you away and away. The man who is not worried to become anything, not even Buddha, Just the other day I was reading about a man who has been meditating for many years, almost 50 years, and he has become very, very old. And he came to a master and said to the master, 50 years, don't you think it is long enough? I have been meditating and meditating. Why I have not become a Buddha yet? And the master laughed and he says, now it explains why you have not become a Buddha yet. Because you want to become. Hence you go on missing. Now it explains everything. If you want to become a Buddha, you will never become. Because a Buddha is one who has dropped all kinds of becoming. Who is utterly happy in this moment for no reason at all. He has nowhere to go, no goal to attain. No target. He has dropped the whole desiring mind. With all its layers, layer upon layer, the mind is like the onion. One layer, the physical, another layer, the psychological, another layer, the spiritual. One who has thrown all those layers, one who has peeled his onion utterly and has come to the innermost core. And you know what is the innermost core? It is empty. If you go on peeling the onion, finally you come to nothingness. Only nothingness is left in your hands. In that nothingness there is orgasmicness, there is bliss. With becoming there is misery. If you want to become something, you will be in pain, misery, anguish, anxiety. If you understand that there is nothing to become, you are already that. Whatsoever you are, you are. There is no way to improve upon it. There is no need to improve upon it. As you are is perfectly okay. Your very ordinariness is utterly extraordinary. To realize this is to come to blessings. Then the whole existence starts showering in blessings on you. It has been showering always, but because you were too much concerned with your own desires and becomings, you were not available to it. You were not open to it. The third characteristic of samadhi is illumination. Great inner transparency, light and clarity. When all these egos disappear, all curtains disappear from our eyes. Look becomes pure. Innocent. Transparency is attained. Then you simply see. And truth is so obvious. It is not hidden. It is not somewhere hiding. It is not avoiding you. It is not on some other planet. It is just in front of your nose. But your eyes are closed. When your eyes open and you have the transparency and the clarity to see the obvious. Truth is the obvious. And the fourth characteristic of samadhi is rest, relaxation. How can you rest with this constant hankering to become something? How rest is possible? You will remain tense. Rest is possible only when all goal orientation has been dropped. When the achieving mind no more functions in you. There is rest. There is relaxation. Thought is mind in motion. No thought is mind at rest. Samadhi is witnessing of both transcendence. You have been running after things, you have seen that and the misery of it. Then you stopped and you have seen the beauty of it, the rest, the relaxation. You have seen both, and the one who has seen both suddenly transcends both. There is a relaxation which is no ordinary relaxation. You know some kind of relaxation. When you feel exhausted, you relax. But that relaxation is very restless. It is not cessation of beginning. It is just tiredness. You have been walking the whole day. You have been working the whole day in the night. You have to fall into sleep. But your sleep will remain restless. You will have many dreams and nightmares. And in the sleep also you will continue to move. Your mind will still go on spinning and weaving. 1001 dreams. Ordinarily, what rest we know is just the other side of restlessness, tiredness, exhaustion. There is a new kind of relaxation. When you have seen the tiredness of desire and you have seen the rest of desirelessness, a totally new kind of relaxation arises. Then, you are relaxed because you are not. You are relaxed because there is nobody to get tense. The very complex has disappeared. How you can be tense? There is nobody. You cannot create a knot inside you because you are not. You have simply disappeared. It is an emptiness inside you. You cannot create knots into emptiness. The fifth characteristic of samadhi is awareness, consciousness, seeing, knowing, witnessing. The fourth state, the Hindus call Turiya. This is what Ikkau means when he says, look, look, look. And when he is asked, what do you mean by look? He says, look means look. Have eyes open. Be alert. Be mindful. See things as they are. Don't create fictions. Don't project. You go to the movie. Sometimes try one experiment. Sometimes try an experiment with a projector in your home. You have to put the screen at a certain distance from the projector. Then the projected pictures are clear. Then start bringing the screen closer to the projector. Soon they start becoming blurred. They are no more clear. You cannot make any distinction what is what, which is which. Bring it still more closer. Now it is impossible to make any sense which is the tree and which is the man and which is the dog and which is the car. All are diffused. Bring it still more closer. The closer you bring, the more distinctions are lost. Then there comes a point when the screen has come very close to the projector, there is only white light left. Black shadows have disappeared. Pure white light. When the beam leaves the projector, it is pure white light. The farther it goes, then it divides into black and white. A certain distance is needed to see the pictures clear. In awareness, exactly this happens. When you become very, very alert, you start looking very closely at reality. And distinctions start disappearing. Trees are no more trees. and rivers are no more rivers, and mountains are no more mountains. All start melting into one. Then you become even more aware, and the more clearly you see into things, the skin comes even more closer. Then there is only pure white light. All the divisions have disappeared. That is what is called awareness. Then all illusions of life are no more valid. There is only pure light, light of awareness. Sixth characteristic of samadhi is deathlessness, timelessness, eternity. When you are not, how can you die? When there is no ego in you, how can you die? Many people used to ask Buddha in his lifetime. Thousands of times the question has been asked. What will happen to you, sir, when you will die? And Buddha always smiles. And he says, there is nobody to die. But he makes it clear that I am not saying that I am immortal. There is nobody to be immortal either. Now, our stupidity is such that first we think we will die. Because the ego is there and we are afraid whether we will be able to keep it, protect it or not. Then comes somebody who knows and he says, nothing dies. Then we project another falsity. We start thinking we are immortal. But the basic error remains the same. First we were thinking we are going to die. We were. And we were going to die. Still we are. Now we are not going to die. Buddha says, I am not going to die because I am not. It is not that I am immortal. There is nobody to die. And there is nobody to be immortal. There is no self. So how death is possible? This is a totally different standpoint. This is the difference between Vedanta and Buddha. This is the difference between Shankara and Buddha. And Buddha's insight is far more penetrating than Shankara's. Shankara goes on saying that you are immortal. Because the soul is immortal. It cannot die. It is deathless. Buddha also says that you will not die, but he never says that you are immortal. He says you will never die because you cannot die. In the first place, you are not. To see it that I am not is to drop both mortality and immortality. Time disappears. What is your immortality? It will be just extension of time. More and more duration. What it will be? 70 years you are going to live, 700 years, 7 million years, but it will be just duration. What is your eternity? Nothing but a desire to cling, a desire to remain always. For what? Just a blind desire to cling to existence, just a blind desire, a blind lust for life. Buddha says, why you are concerned with mortality and immortality? Deep down, those who say they will die and those who say we will never die, both are the same because both believe in the ego. The Charvakas, the materialists say we will die. And the so-called spiritualists say we will not die. But both are concerned with the ego. Buddha brings a new breeze into human minds, into human consciousness. He says you will not die, not because you are immortal, but because you are not. See the point of it, the radical change. The basic revolution of it. Deathlessness is part of the phenomenon of samadhi. And seventh is infinity. Space disappears. You are nowhere and yet everywhere. You are nobody and yet everybody. These are the seven characteristics of samadhi. And this is what happened to this archer who wanted to become the greatest archer in the world. The story does not say what he learned in those 9 years when he was with the old man in the mountains. This is what he learned. Samadhi he learned. That's why I started with samadhi. So that you become aware what he learned there. Because that is the real point in the story. The whole story revolves around one word, samadhi. Wu, satori. Now the story. Chichang aspired to be the greatest archer in the world. That's what everybody is aspiring. To be the greatest in the world, archer, painter, poet, politician, or you name it. But that's what mind aspires, to be the greatest in the world. Mind is an ego trip. The mind wants to stand in front of all. In fact, it is not possible. Hence, mind ultimately leads into frustration. It is not possible to be first in the line because there is no line. We are standing in a circle. There is always somebody who is ahead of you. There will always be somebody who will be ahead of you. You cannot come to a point where you are the first man. Even those who become presidents and prime ministers and kings, even they are never the first. In fact, the moment they start feeling they are the first, they become aware that how impotent and helpless they are. We are not standing in a queue. We are moving in a circle. Somebody is behind you, somebody is ahead of you. In fact, if you look deep, the one who is behind you is also ahead of you. If you look the whole circle, the man who is standing behind you from the other end, he is ahead of you. And the man who is standing in front of you from the other end is behind you. It is a circle. Life moves in circles. It is not linear. Everything moves in circles. Let this sink in your heart. Whenever you are thinking about any problem in life, always remain the circular. It is not linear. The stars move in circle. The earth moves in circle. The seasons move in circle. Childhood, youth, old age move in a circle. Everything moves in a circle. Linear movement is a mind construct, imaginary. In fact, there are new mathematicians, new geometries, non-Euclidean geometries, which believe that you cannot draw a simple straight line. That's not possible. A straight line is impossible to draw. Because we are on a globe. The earth is round. You can draw a straight line just in front of you on this floor. But it will not be really straight. If you go on drawing it from both the ends, one day it will become a circle around the earth. So when it was looking straight, it was only a fragment of the big circle. It was an arc. An incomplete circle, that's all. It was not straight. Straight lines cannot be drawn. Because straight lines don't exist, Albert Einstein has to propound a very absurd thing that space is curved. Straight lines can't exist, so space has to be curved. Even space, which means nothingness, is curved. It is not straight. It is very difficult to conceive how nothingness can be curved. Something can be curved, but how nothingness can be curved? Nothing is nothing. How the curve will arise out of nothing? But Einstein is right. He says when nothing exists as a straight line, then we cannot conceive even space as a straight line. It is curved. Everything is a curve. So nobody ever comes to be the first. In fact, those who think they have come to be the first are the most frustrated men in the world. That's why Buddha left his empire, became a beggar, recognizing the fact that I look to all apparent purposes to be the first, but I am not. This man, Chi Chang, aspired to be the greatest archer in the world, so he became the pupil of Wei Fei. First, Wei Fei ordered him to learn not to blink. Concentration is a first necessity for anybody who has any kind of ambition. Concentration is the way to ambition. This man was ambitious. The master said, okay, the first thing to learn is not to blink. Chi Chang crept under his wife's loom and lay there on his back, staring without blinking at the treadle as it rushed up and down directly before his eyes. After 2 years, he had reached the point of not blinking even if one of his eyelashes was caught in the treadle. He attained to concentration. To know how not to blink is only the first step, said Wei Fei. The master said, good. But this is only the first step. Next, you must learn to look. Practice looking at things. And if the time comes when what is minute seems conspicuous and what is small seems huge, visit me once more. Now the second step is to look into things so penetratingly that even the small starts looking big. It depends how penetrating you look, how deeply you look into things. If you look indifferently, even the Himalayas is a small thing. It is relative. If you look very, very deeply, even a small particle is bigger than the Himalayas. It depends on the proportion how deeply you look. The atomic becomes cosmic if the look is cosmic, and the cosmic becomes atomic if the look is atomic. Ordinarily we look very indifferently. We go on missing. God is everywhere. From every tree He has been calling you. And from every rock He has been inviting you. In every river are His sermons. But you are indifferent. You don't know how to look. So you go on missing. He is in the minutest, in the smallest, but you go on missing. It is not that He is not there, that's why you are missing. You miss only because you don't know how to look. The master said, now you learn to look. Practice looking at things, and if the time comes that you start seeing the small as the huge, come back. Chai Cheng searched for a tiny insect hardly visible to the naked eye, placed it on a blade of grass and hung it by the window of his study. He then took up a position at the end of the room and sat there day after day, staring at the insect. At first he could hardly see it, but after 10 days he began to fancy that it was slightly bigger. For 3 years he hardly left his study. Then one day he perceived that the insect by the window was as big as a horse. "I have done it," he exclaimed. This time the teacher was sufficiently impressed to say, "Well done," because this man has done something valuable. He has transformed the size of a small insect just by looking at it constantly. Now, the cosmic can be found in the atomic. And that is one of the basic lessons in archery. You have to see the small as used. Only then your target will never be missed. Only then you will become an archer. In Zen, archery has been used for centuries as a technique for meditation. It is, because it needs almost the same qualities as meditation needs. First, a non-blinking eye. Second, the capacity to look into things so deeply that the things start changing their size. Their size starts depending on your look. Chai Cheng soon became a master of archery. And no feat of bowmanship now seemed beyond his powers. He seemed close to the achievement of his ambition. But with an unpleasant jolt he realized that one obstacle remained. So long as the master lived, Chi Cheng would never call himself the greatest archer in the world. That's what happens always to ambition. When you are nearing to the end, suddenly you recognize one thing very basically is missing. Somebody is still ahead of you. And ambition is very violent. Even if it is your master, you can kill him. Ambition is violence. An ambitious man can never be non-violent. An ambitious man can never love. Not even his own master is safe. An ambitious man is a dangerous man. Ambition is poison. It poisons you. Now this archer recognized the fact that I have become the greatest archer, but only one problem remains: the master is alive. I can never claim to be the first till he is alive. A natural conclusion: kill him. Ambition kills. You have been killing. Everybody has been killing because there is ambition. In direct ways, in indirect ways, everybody is a murderer because everybody is ambitious. Only non-ambition is non-violent. So let it be remembered always, you cannot become non-violent if there is ambition still. Any kind of ambition will never allow you compassion. How you can be compassionate if there is ambition? You have still to fight, still to make your way. And when there is ambition, all means are right. Who bothers about the means? The end is the thing. Walking through the fields one day, Chi Cheng caught sight of Wei Fei far in the distance. He saw the old man, and this is his master, and he has been teaching him all these years. Without a moment's hesitation, he raised his bow, fixed an arrow, and took aim. His old master, however, had sensed what was happening, and in a flash had also notched an arrow. He must have noticed it since the day this man had come to him, because an ambitious man is never a disciple. An ambitious man is never surrendered. His surrender is just technical. His surrender is not of the heart. The master must have known it, that sooner or later he is to go against me. Sooner or later, his ambition will create the idea in his mind to destroy me. So the master must have been alert. All masters have always been alert about ambitious disciples. There is every possibility that Judas was the most ambitious disciple of Jesus. He had reasons to be. He was the most learned, the most scholarly, most rational. And he used to think that he is even more intelligent than Jesus. He used to argue with Jesus. And if you listen to his arguments, sometimes you will feel convinced with him rather than with Jesus. Because Jesus is not argumentative. He had his own reasons, but those reasons are very subtle. Only when you have eyes you can see, otherwise not. Judas' reasons are very apparent, very familiar. One day a woman came and poured very, very valuable perfume on Jesus' feet. And Judas was there, and he didn't miss the opportunity, and he said, "Look, you should have prevented her. This is wastage." It was so valuable that the whole town could have been invited to a feast, and people are poor. His argument was exactly that of a socialist or a communist. Judas is a socialist. He says the whole village would have eaten well. They would have enjoyed. You should have prevented her. What is this nonsense? And what Jesus says? And Jesus says, the poor people will always be here when I am gone. You can serve them when I am gone. Now this is not very appealing. Or do you think it is very appealing? It doesn't seem very appealing. Seems to be a very important argument. That I will be gone soon, so let her do whatsoever she wants to do. Poor people will always be here. On the surface, Judas seems to be more solid. If votes are asked for, Judas is going to win. But Jesus' point is of a totally different plane. He is saying these things don't matter. Even if you give feast to the whole village, that is not going to help much. But to prevent this woman who had come with such prayers in her heart would have destroyed a great possibility of growth. To say no to her, to stop her, would have been very, very destructive. She is delicate. She is fragile. It is not the perfume that Jesus is looking at. He is looking at the heart of the woman. But the head never looks at the heart. The head has its own reasons. Buddha's disciple Devadatta betrayed him. He was one of the most intelligent people around him. He was one of his cousin brothers. He was as from a royal family as he himself was. He betrayed Buddha. Mahavira's own son-in-law betrayed him. He was the most educated, cultured person around Mahavira. Why? Ambitious people. That son-in-law of Mahavira had the ambition to become the greatest teacher in the world. And Mahavira was standing on the way. Till Mahavira is alive, it is difficult. Devadatta had the ambition to become the greatest Buddha of the world. Until Gautam Buddha is alive, it was difficult. Devadatta tried to kill Buddha in many ways. He made many attempts on his life. Ambition is poisonous. It makes people blind. Their arrows collided halfway and fell together to the ground. The strange duel continued until the master's quiver was empty, but one arrow still remained with the pupil. This is symbolic. Master is old. The pupil is young. The master is already getting ready to die. "Now is my chance," muttered Chichang, who immediately aimed the final arrow. Seeing this, Weifei broke off a twig from a thorn bush beside him, and as the arrow sped towards his heart, he flipped the point sharply with the tip of one of the thorns and brought it to the ground at his feet. This was the last trick the master has not yet taught. Every master has to be careful to keep at least one thing secret. "But now," he said, "my friends," listen to the word he says, "my friends." What he is meaning? He is saying, "I am no more your master. You are no more my disciple. Now forgive me. Now forget me. Now I declare you my friend, and I have taught you all that I knew, even the last trick. You have seen it and you know it. I have now, as you realize, transmitted to you all the knowledge of Arshri that I possess. If you wish to delve further into these mysteries, you must seek the aged master Kan Ing. Compared to his school, our bowmanship is as the puny fumbling of children." Now, even if he was going to kill his master, the master sends him on another journey. Master sends him to his own masters, the old man in the mountains. He says, "What we know is just childish. I am not yet myself the greatest archer in the world. You can please forgive me. If you really want to become the greatest archer in the world, now you go to another. My own master is still alive. Compared to his art, we don't know anything." After months of arduous climbing, Chicheng reached the cave where dwelt Kan Ing and announced to the old man, "I have come to find out if I am as great an archer as I believe." And without waiting for a reply, he notched an arrow, aimed at a flock of migrating birds, and brought down 5 birds all at once. The old man smiled and said, "But this is mere shooting with bow and arrow. Have you not yet learned to shoot without shooting? Come with me." That is the difference between a technician and an artist. The technician knows all the technique, but that is not enough. You can know all about how to paint, yet you don't become a Michelangelo. You can know all about music and how to create it, yet you don't become a Beethoven. Knowledge of the technique is needed, but is not all. Is necessary, but not enough. The real transcendence comes only when the technique is forgotten, when the technique is no more needed, when you can work without the technique. That is the meaning of it. But this is mere shooting with bow and arrow. Good, as far as it goes with bow and arrow. But this is nothing. Have you not yet learned to shoot without shooting? If you meditate with a technique, it is mere shooting with bow and arrow. The day you drop all techniques of meditation and meditation flows without any techniques and without any methods, it is real shooting. When the meditation becomes perfect, meditation disappears. That is the point of perfection, when you don't need it. When love becomes perfect, you forget the word love. When you have really arrived and you have become happy, you don't know that you are happy. How can you know that you are happy? Only an unhappy person can know that he is happy. It is known only in comparison, in contrast. If you create music on the instrument, you don't know yet that there is a music that is already overflowing in existence, and it needs no instrument to create it. It needs only an open heart to hear it. In fact, when music is created by an instrument, something of the music that surrounds, that vibrates all over existence, is reflected in it, that's all. Something of it reflected in it. It is an echo, far distant echo. Even that satisfies so much. So what to say about the real music? That real music in India we call Anahatanath. Unstruck. Not created by striking an instrument. Not creating by pulling wires. Striking by making any effort. But by becoming so utterly silent that one hears it. That is what Zen people call the sound of one hand clapping. All other sounds are created sounds, struck, two hands clapping. But when two hands are clapping, the sound is momentary. It will be there for a moment, it will quiver there for a moment, and then it is gone. But there is an eternal music. The celestial music, Pythagorean talk, the music of the stars, which has to be heard. There is no need to create it. It is already there. It has been there. It is the very nature of existence itself. The master said, "Then come with me." Chai Cheng followed him in silence to the edge of a great cliff. When he glanced down, his eyes became blurred and his head began to spin. A great edge overlooking a cliff, abysmal, and he must have felt sickness, nausea, arising in his stomach. He must have become afraid. When you are afraid, how can you be an archer? When death still affects you, how you can be perfect archer? When fear is there, trembling is there, and if trembling is there, how your target can be perfect? Maybe ordinary people will not see the quiver in your hands when you are shooting the arrow. But you cannot avoid the eyes of one who knows. He will see the quiver in your hands, the trembling. If your heart is trembling, what is happening there standing on that cliff is nothing new. Only death has been brought to be an obvious fact confronting. the man has become afraid. He must have been afraid of death always. In fact, the mind is always afraid of death, and the ambitious mind more so. The ambitious mind is very much afraid of death. The fear is it going that I will be able to do it before death comes? Will I manage? Will I succeed before death comes, or am I going to fail? The ambitious man is more afraid of death than the non-ambitious. The non-ambitious has nothing to lose if death comes. Okay, he was not here fulfilling any ambition. So death cannot take anything away from him. The old master must have looked. Those old eyes are penetrating. Those ancient eyes must have seen the trembling inside of this man. In fact, through ambition we want to prove our ego against death. But nothing can be proved against death. The ego has to go. The ego has to die. It cannot be deathless. You can have as much money as you desire, but you will have to die. You can have as much power as possible, but you will have to die. Nothing can protect you. He glanced down, his eyes became blurred and his head began to spin. Meanwhile, the master conning ran. Listen, ran lightly onto a narrow ledge which jutted straight out over the precipice, and turning round said, "Now show me your rear skill. Come here where I am standing and let me see your bowmanship." When Chi Chang stepped on the ledge, it began to sway slightly to and fro. He tried to notch an arrow, but soon he felt that he was going to lose his balance. He lay down on the ledge, clutching its edges firmly with his fingers. His legs shook and the perspiration flowed from his whole body. Now the old man has reduced him to his reality. All that ego, all that ambition, all that idea of being the greatest archer in the world, all finished. Just the fear, and he is trembling like a small child who has got lost. All our achievements are like that. When you will face death, they will all be meaningless. Suddenly you will find you are just the same child you have always been, afraid, trembling. The old man laughed. He reached out his hand and helped Chai Cheng down. Jumping onto it himself, he said, "Allow me, sir, to show you what archery really is." "What about your bow?" asked Chi Cheng, naturally. "If you go to Buddha, you will ask, sir, how do you meditate? What is your method? If you go to Jesus, you will ask, sir, how do you pray? What is your prayer?" You will be asking absurd questions. Jesus has nothing to say to God. His prayer is not that of saying something to God. His prayer is only that of listening. And Buddha does not practice any meditation, because all practice is of the mind. The mind has disappeared. Buddha is meditation. This is difficult for us. Buddha is not doing meditation. Buddha is meditation. People come to me, "Do you love us?" they ask. It is difficult for them, because they know only one kind of love, which has to be done. They don't know another kind, the real kind. There is love and there is love. The other kind need not be done. It is simply there. "I don't love you, I am love." That's a totally different kind. It may not feel very good to your ego, but you don't know the real coin. You know only the false coin. The real love is not a relationship. It is a state of being. "What about your bow?" asked Chichen. "My bow?" said the old man, laughing. "So long as one requires bow and arrow, one is still at the periphery of the arch. Real archery dispenses with both and arrow. Bow and arrow both. Real art always dispenses with the techniques. If you are involved in the techniques, you are on the periphery. Good. Nothing wrong about it. But remember, one has to go beyond them. One has to go beyond all confinements. One has to go beyond all methods. One has to become so spontaneous that no method is needed. Meditation is you. Love is you. God is you." Directly above their heads, a single kite was wheeling in the sky. The hermit looked up at it, and Chi Cheng followed his gaze. So high was the bird that even to his sharp eyes it looked like a small sesame seed. Kan Ing notched an invisible arrow on an incorporeal bow, drew the string to its full extension, and released it. The next moment the kite stopped flapping its wings and fell like a stone to the ground. It happens. It is not a miracle. If a mind who is totally silent just thinks about anything, it happens. That's why all the old scriptures of the world say one thing, that before you attain to samadhi, you should drop all kinds of wrong thoughts from your mind. Otherwise, you can be a danger to humanity. Now, there is the secret why Patanjali insists so much, that first, drop all vices of the mind. Why Buddha insists, drop all wrong ideas from the mind. Why Mahavira says, drop violence, drop untruth, drop attachment. Why? Because once you attain to silence, whatsoever arises in your mind will be immediately fulfilled. You can become dangerous. And sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens a person becomes meditative, and much danger happens into the world. That happened in the case of Rasputin. He was a meditative man. But not prepared for it. Accidentally he had stumbled upon meditation. He prayed hard. He prayed long for many years. And then he knew. And then he became capable of doing things. Whatsoever he will say will happen. He has said to the Tsar of Russia. The wife of the Tsar was very much devoted to him, but the Tsar was a little reluctant. And Rasputin was afraid that the Tsar may throw him out. One day he said to the Tsar, that remember, if I die, your whole kingdom is going to disappear. Only with me your kingdom can stay. And that's how it happened. He was killed, and the next thing was the revolution. The whole Tsar family was killed. 18 members, even the child of 2 months old. All that Rasputin said were fulfilled. He was very prophetic. It happens sometimes. that a man stumbles accidentally on meditation. It is better to move very slowly, very carefully. It is not a miracle if a man like Khan Ing simply imagines that the kite will fall down. It will fall down. Because we are joined with each other. What happens when I move my hands? It is a miracle. A thought arises in me to move the hand. And the hand moves. Now hand is matter. And thought is not matter. It is a mystery for science. It has not been explained how it happens. The thought arises and the hand moves. Where the thought is transformed into matter and how it can be transformed. If the hand can move, then why not your hand can move? If the thought arises in me that let your hand move, your hand can also move and you can try it. And sometimes you will be surprised it happens. You are following somebody. Just go on looking at the back of his neck. After 2-3 minutes, just deep inside, says loudly inside, not aloud, but say strongly inside, look back at me, and you will be surprised. The person immediately looks back at you. What has happened? The thought has been transferred. The thought jumped, reached to the other person. A man of the capacity of Khan Ing can easily do it. Just the idea. And the kite is not far away. We are joined. We live in an ocean of thought. We are all together. Each affects each other. We are members of each other. For 9 years, Chi Cheng stayed in the mountains with the old hermit. What disciplines he underwent during this time, none ever knew. When in the 10th year he returned home, all were amazed at the change in him. His former resolute and arrogant countenance had disappeared. All that ambitiousness, all that egoistic trip that I want to become the greatest archer in the world has disappeared with this old man. In fact, the self disappears. All those 3 egos, physical, psychological, spiritual, disappears. He was no more arrogant, no more humble leader. In its place had come the look of a simpleton, like an idiot. A simpleton. As if he has no more any mind. As if he is mindless. Or like a child. Or like a fool. Or like an imbecile. This is the highest stage of being a simpleton. It is exactly like this that has happened to Saint Francis of Assisi. He was a simpleton. It is exactly the same case with Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Li Tzu. And particularly in Tao, this is the highest stage, to become a simpleton. Not knowing what is what, not knowing at all. When all selves have disappeared, there is utter silence and ignorance. And ignorance is very intimate. One knows nothing. One is not how one can know anything. His old teacher Weifei came to visit him and said after a single glance, "Now I see that you have indeed become an expert. Such as I are no longer worthy ever to touch your feet." The inhabitants of his city hailed Chi Cheng as the greatest archer in the world and impatiently awaited the wonderful feats which he would no doubt soon display. But Chi Cheng did nothing to satisfy their expectations. There was nobody left to satisfy their expectations. He was just a silence now, an emptiness. The great poplar bow which he had taken with him on his journey, he evidently had left behind. When someone asked him to explain, he answered in a languid tone, "The ultimate stage of activity is inactivity. The ultimate stage of speaking is to refrain from speech. The ultimate in suiting is not to suit. The ultimate is negative. The positive is the periphery. The negative is the center. The ultimate is like nothingness, sunyata." Chi Cheng grew old. More and more he seemed to have entered the state in which both mind and body look no longer to things outside, but exist by themselves in restful and elegant simplicity. Elegant simplicity. It was not a simplicity practiced. It was not a simplicity cultivated. It was elegant. It was natural. The ego has disappeared. That's why there was simplicity. You can practice simplicity, but then it is just a decoration to the ego. There are two kinds of simplicities. One simplicity, the so-called Mahatma, the saint, who practices it. It is a very calculated move, a calculated gesture. It is very cunning. It is not simplicity. It is a facage. Then there is another kind of simplicity, elegant, graceful, spontaneous, uncultivated, natural. It is like that of a child, unself-conscious. Hence elegant, hence graceful. His stolid face divested itself of every vestige of expression. No outside force could disturb his complete impassiveness. It was rare now for him to speak, and presently one could no longer tell whether or not he still breathed. In the evening of his life he no longer knew the difference between this and that. The kaleidoscope of sensory impressions no longer concerned him. For all he cared, his eye might have been an ear, his ear a nose, his nose a mouth. All distinctions disappeared. He knew nothing. He knew nothing of this and that. 1,001 things all became one. Everything became merged into everything else. It was one unity, this whole existence, without any distinctions, without any divisions, all pigeonholes, all categories left behind. Of his last year, the story is told that one day he visited a friend's house and saw lying on a table a vaguely familiar utensil whose name and use he could, however, not recall. He turned to his friend and said, "Pray, tell me, that object on your table, what is it called and for what it is used?" The friend stammered out in an awe-struck tone, "Ah, master, you must indeed be the greatest master of all times. Only so can you have forgotten the bow, both its name and its use." It was said that for some time after this in the city, painters threw away their brushes, musicians broke the strings of their instruments, and carpenters were ashamed to be seen with their rules. This is what Zen is. Zen is not a method. Zen is going beyond all methods. Zen is not a way. Zen is dropping all the ways to arrive home. Zen is not a journey. There is no goal in it. Zen is disappearance of all journeys and the sudden recognition that you are there already. that you have been there always. Zen is a certain illumination, abrupt, not gradual, because gradual means practicing step by step. Zen is sudden. Nothing has to be practiced. It is already the case. That which you are seeking is already within you. The seeker is the sought. Just you have to stop seeking and look. Look into your form and you will not find it. Look into your mind and you will not find it. Look into yourself and you will not find it. And when all these three have not been found, you will find who you are. Enough for today.